Welcome to Marissa's Wicked Word Nosh, a place to chow down on topics relevant to writers of all kinds.
Hello, and welcome to Marissa's Wicked Word Nosh. I'm Marissa, and this is a weekly podcast in which I talk about a wide variety of writing-related topics, and sometimes I have an interview with a really cool guest, which is the case this week. I spoke about a week ago to Brooke Nisley. Brooke and I have been following each other on Twitter for some time, and she recently posted something about appearing on more podcasts, and I took her up on it. I said, I'd love to have you on my podcast. So we talked about it, and we sat down, and we made it happen. And I'm really glad I got a chance to speak to Brooke, because we spoke about a lot of topics that I feel really need to be discussed, both on a writing level, but also on a societal level. And my eyes were open to some things that I was not aware of before I talked to Brooke. So I'm glad we had the chance to talk, and I really think that you will get a lot out of this interview. So with no further ado, here's my conversation with Brooke. Enjoy.
So my guest today is Brooke Nisley. Brooke is a disabled writer and writing instructor whose work has appeared in Vulture, Playboy, McSweeney's, and others. She's working on a memoir about trauma and its damage. Brooke, it's really great to have you on the show. I was just saying on your website, there was so much when I was looking at it, so many pieces that I wanted to read that I wasn't sure where to start at first. So I'll start off with a pretty basic question. What made you want to start writing?
I know that's a basic question, but oh gosh, that's so difficult. So I have always been a big reader from a young age. I read a lot, which is a pretty standard response to that standard question. And I loved writing, and I wrote short stories and all the time. In third grade, a teacher took one of my short stories home and read it to her family because she was like, I've never seen the ending like this before. And it ended where I died. I led a pirate ship cruise somewhere. And then I was
wow.
And basically all the men died. I died too, but I made sure all the families got their share of gold. My teacher took it home, read it to her family, and told my parents. It was like, I'm impressed but concerned that Brooke dies at the end of all her stories. That's a little macabre, but I thought it was really funny. I thought that was the best way to end things was and then they all died, but it was okay.
Yeah.
So that was kind of a tangent, but yeah, so that's how I started writing. And then as I got older, I went to community college, messed around, didn't get a lot done, transferred. And then I transferred as a literature major. And then from there, I, got in an accident, fell out of a tree, got brain damage. And then I was like, whoa, I need a direction in life because I need to be able to take care of myself and have health insurance. So then I went to grad school for writing and literature, or writing and publishing, because I was already doing writing and I was pretty good at it. So I freelanced all the way through grad school, which is how I paid for it and my bills and things. Yeah. So it just kind of rolled from there.
That's great. I wanted to talk, if it's okay, a little more about the disability articles, because I was looking through them when I was on your website. And again, I was really impressed by a lot of the things that you wrote there. Do you see writing as something that's therapeutic for you, or is it something that you feel you need to do? I noticed that you had articles about, say, how various disabilities, they don't get enough attention. And now, especially with COVID, there seems to be a lot of confusion there with how to handle, first of all, you had disabilities, which in a lot of cases weren't receiving enough attention pre-COVID. And now with COVID, a lot of people aren't sure how to proceed with that. Do you feel it's something that you need to do to raise more awareness, or is it something that's both for you?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because I do think it's both, but I also feel like, you know, of course, pre-COVID, people have this conception of what a disabled person looks like. I do not look like a disabled person. If you see me on the street, even walking, you would be like, oh, she hurt her leg or something. Maybe that's right. Why she's dragging it behind her. You know, I can't count the number of times I've had people say to me, but you don't look disabled. And I was like, yeah, because all disabled people look the same. So pre-COVID, that it was super difficult having an invisible disability, because so many people would say to me, you don't look disabled. And I was like, well, I am, and I really need help, and I can't write this, and my hands don't work. And so advocating for myself, like it helped that I've always been kind of, am I allowed to cuss?
You can, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I've always been kind of an asshole. So I am very like brusque, very just like, I don't like that. And that worked a lot to my benefit after being disabled, because then people would say rude things to me and I would be like, that's really rude. You're kind of a jerk. You probably shouldn't say something like that to me. Someone who struggles with disability every day of her life.
Yeah.
That's really dismissive. And people, it was so interesting. Reactions would go from people being very embarrassed to people getting angry at me, being like, you can't talk to me that way. I'm like, you started it. and then with COVID, it was even more disturbing, because I teach freshmen, and I was teaching in person when COVID canceled everything, of course. And I had students come in on March 12th, March 12th or 13th. It was the Tuesday before everything locked down. And I had one student in one of my classes, because I was teaching two sections. She said before class started, well, I'm not too concerned. Like, we'll all be okay. Like, the only people who are really going to be, like, in trouble with this are, like, old people and disabled people and things like that. And I looked at her and I was like,
okay.
You realize I'm disabled, right? And she's like, but you're young. And I was like, yeah, I am young, but I'm also immunocompromised.
Yeah.
Like, me. I'm the people that you're like, it's no big deal. They're going to die. And it was this weird, really weird moment, because I could tell with the look on her face, she was horrified. And I was like, hey, I know that you probably never had to consider this before, but not all disabled people are older, or like that preconceived notion you have about them, and they're also not disposable. That's so nuts to me that someone would say that, you know. And she probably heard it so often from other people in her life, it just didn't even blip in her mind as something that would be that terrible. I was like, essentially, you just told me that I could die, and like, whatever.
Wow, that's I don't even know what to say to that. It's like, it amazes me. I spent a few years tutoring students that had learning disabilities, ADHD, traumatic brain injury. So I know a lot of what you're saying about invisible disabilities and things like that. But it seems to me like there's a lot of lip service you've been seeing especially since COVID. A lot of people have been saying, oh, a lot of people are having mental health issues being in isolation and dealing with a pandemic. Oh, we have to do so much to help them. But I still don't see a lot of that actually happening. It seems like a lot of people are trying to come across as more empathetic to that kind of thing, but they're, you know, they're just saying it. They think that's going to be enough, and they're not actually doing anything to rectify the situation, basically.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. I wrote an article for Bitch Media at the very beginning of the pandemic, and I said, I was like, disabled teachers are like fodder right now. They just don't care about us. They're just throwing us by the wayside. And disabled students that require screen readers, different types of devices, you know, to learn, especially digitally. The digital landscape is far from accessible, which is another big misconception that a lot of people have. They think that digital things inherently makes them accessible, but that's not true. And so I wrote an article for Bitch Media about how no one's taking these steps. And because everyone was moving online so quickly, they weren't acknowledging the needs that these disabled students and the disabled instructors would have.
It also seems that from the writing that I looked at, that you're open about your own experiences, and I saw that you're writing a memoir about what you've been through. How would you recommend that someone who has an injury or disability who might want to write but who may not be used to being open about their experiences, because I know sometimes there could be like some trauma that they might have suppressed at some point. How would you recommend that they deal with something like that in their writing, like maybe becoming more comfortable with opening up? Like, how would you recommend somebody goes about doing that?
So it was interesting for me because I never wrote any really like personal pieces or nonfiction before my accident. And after it, during rehab, you mentioned traumatic brain injury. That's what I have. I have a traumatic brain injury.
Right.
After my coma and I was released from the acute facility and then I went into outpatient therapy, they were like, oh, you're a writer. You study literature. You should write stories. That'll help you to reform the connections in your brain and remember all these past things. And I was like, okay. They were like, well, write about what happened to you, what you remember. And I was like, I don't really know if I can do that because I don't really remember things. And then at that time, I was really messed up. And I just, like, I would start a sentence, and by the time the sentence ended, it wouldn't really end because I would forget what I was saying, and it would just kind of just, like, Even now you could probably tell that I'm, like, I stopped. I'm, like, trying to recollect things. And that's part of the reason why I talk fast, too. I'm, like, I gotta get it out before I forget it. My poor students. So I started doing that, and instead of just writing exactly what I knew, I started writing in the gaps and the things I remembered and the things that I didn't quite remember, but the things surrounding it. So it became this like weird meta writing of writing through the writing process as well as the memories, and writing the memories into existence and trying to like recreate them, this weird detective work. So the advice, so all that background, just to say, the advice I would give people who aren't very good at connecting with these previous memories for whatever reason, because they can't remember them, because they were very traumatic, get a therapist. First and foremost, everyone should have a therapist. I have a therapist. I love her. And yeah, some of the hard stuff I have to, you know, talk with her first, obviously. But then look at it as an act of meta writing, like writing about writing almost. And what goes into you trying to reformulate these memories and ideas? And if you look at it through that, it feels like you're more distanced, it's more scientific. So you're able to write it cold because you're looking at how you were, you're viewing yourself as a character, as opposed to writing about this thing that may be too close to you.
Okay, that's great. I want to talk a little more about humor too, because there's also a section on your website, like comedy writing. Were you always funny? And would you say there's a style of humor that particularly you relate to, or is it just something like, how do you see humor, basically? What role does humor play in your life? I'm a huge fan of humor, by the way, so.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm funny. I think I've always been funny.
Yeah.
My family, no, not so much. My brother was the one, they were always like, oh, Jesus, so funny. But he was, like, more slapstick, kind of, like, out, what am I trying to think of? Like the Three Stooges type of thing, and just like
yeah,
that kind of Will Ferrell-esque humor.
Yeah.
And I had a very dry delivery, like to the point where they couldn't even tell I was joking sometimes. And that was really funny to me.
Yeah.
And I was playing to my favorite audience, Brooke Nisely. And so I, often the most humor I would get is someone saying something and then replying deadpan, with something kind of ridiculous, and then people not knowing if I'm serious or not and their confusion. That was super funny to me. So I did that a lot. And so my family did not think I was funny when I was younger. They were just like, Brooke is very weird and has a very weird view on life. It's like, I don't really think those things. But yeah, so growing up, I was not the funny one. But I love cracking jokes. I think to be like a comedian or a comedy writer or any like a humorist or any sort of writer that uses humor as a tool is to have this appreciation for absurdity, and that
yeah.
you know, humor is all about incongruence. And is that not life? That
exactly.
We expect so much, and then we really get what we expect. And that dramatic irony between what we expect and what we definitely don't get, if you can find an appreciation for that, then you probably like humor and you probably like cracking jokes. And if you can't, you know, do that, then you may appreciate humor, but I don't know. I can't speak to joke writing abilities because I feel like the incongruence is a big part of that. Did I answer your question? That was a long question.
You did. No, I think that's great. What do you think? Because I've talked about humor in a bunch of podcast episodes in the past, and I actually like to read a lot of humor. And what do you think works in a piece of, like, say, comedy writing, and what doesn't work?
Well, I think it really depends on what type of comedy writing you're doing too, because like satirical pieces, you gotta sell that idea. You have to
yeah.
be completely on board to whatever bit you're doing, because
yeah.
if you drop it even for a moment right in the middle, then your readers are just gonna be like, nope, don't believe it. And when they stop believing, when they're not playing your game anymore, then it's over. That's it. You've lost them.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And I feel that way about most comedy, honestly. If you're going to sell the bit, you got to sell it. You
yeah.
have to believe it. And then it really helps if you genuinely think what you're writing is funny. I know personally, I have tried, women's magazines will do those little, I guess they're satire pieces, but satire, like dating satire pieces. There's certain topics that
right.
I didn't grow up reading women's magazines. I don't understand like the nuances of that. So those fall flat for me. So again, you have to know your audience, know what you're writing for. Cause I've definitely done that before. I have cracked jokes to people. Definitely shouldn't have cracked jokes too.
Yeah. I've done that before myself.
Yeah. Yeah. Which again, hilarious for me, and then afterwards I laughed about it, but those poor people, they're probably like, that girl is a monster. Yeah, so that was my long-winded way of saying if a piece doesn't work, it's normally because you're doing it for the wrong audience, or you're not selling it, you're not committing to the bit.
yeah that makes sense. So you have the comedy pieces and you have the serious pieces, and is it easy for you to switch from writing with a humorous mindset to maybe one needed for a more serious piece? Do you find that you can combine them, or that there are similarities? Like, how do you, like, I guess, transition from, say, comedy to a more serious piece?
My dirty secret is that I don't, and that I don't file my first draft, because my first draft is so dark, it's so twisted. because for the serious pieces, I pretty much write everything kind of funny, and I make a lot of jokes that are really, like, not good. I mean, they're constructed very well. I mean, I'm good at what I do. But they're just, like, I would not share them. I would not share them with anyone, because they're very dark. So I'll write a serious piece, and I'll include jokes and whatever thoughts I have. I'm like, and then I'll go back and take out all those jokes and put them in another doc and be like, save you for later. Maybe I can do something with you. But not for this piece for Huffington Post about people with disabilities being overlooked during COVID. Not here. But that's just how I deal with a lot of things. Is that it, when it's really hard, my coping mechanism is cracking jokes about it.
I'm
better
the same
or
way.
Worse.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and I feel like a lot of writers, especially ones I've talked to, a lot of comedy writers or writers who infuse their pieces with comedy, have that mechanism, and it's great. I think it's a really healthy one. My therapist thinks so too.
Yeah.
It's a really healthy coping mechanism. But again, it comes down to audience, and I'm not going to be cracking jokes about this very serious thing to an audience of news readers. But then I might write a piece for McSweeney's about things people say to me when they realize I won't have health insurance after I graduate, which is something I wrote.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm the same way. I think it's a good way to cope when you're going through a hard time or when you have something that is chronic, maybe something that you have to deal with for a long period of time. And a lot of people don't understand that. They think when you're going through something, you have to be serious all the time, and it kind of catches them off guard if you're waiting for, like, serious test results and you crack a joke. They're like, what's wrong with you? So think for a lot of us, it definitely helps if we can look at it that way. So, so I wanted to talk a little bit more about your freelance writing. Now, what advice, I think you might have spoke about this a little bit already, but if you could go into more detail, for somebody who might be looking to go into freelance work, either full-time or maybe on the side, what advice would you give to a freelance writer as far as putting a portfolio together and looking for opportunities to become published?
Definitely. So I feel like there's a lot of misconceptions also about starting out. Like, I didn't have a website right off the bat starting off or a portfolio put together. I just had clips. I think there were, you know what, there were links from, I was like, what were they? I had written for my undergraduate campus's paper for 2 months. I got like 3 clips, but I was like, whatever, that works. And so I was seeing those as samples at first, and they worked. People, that's the thing too, is that if you have a good story in it and your pitch is constructed well, the clips don't matter all that much. They just want to see that you've written things before and that you've constructed story. So yeah, so it doesn't matter if your clips are from like the Washington Post versus UC Santa Cruz City on a Hill Press, named after like a hill that the campus is on, whatever.
Right.
but I always thought that name was stupid and it reminded me of like Puritan, the early, but whatever. Andrew, sorry.
No, that's okay.
But yeah, so your clips don't matter all that much. Even if you don't have any clips, if you have a good story idea, and then your pitch kind of works as a clip. If you construct that pitch in such a way that it's snappy to the point, you don't put a lot of fillers in, like I'm doing right now, going like, oh. But if you have a pitch that's clean, nice, good story, and you get it to the right editor, and the right editor sees it, you'll get a story. They'll publish you. That being said, pitching in itself is an art form.
If you could talk a little more about that, because pitching for freelance is something that I've always kind of, I mean, I tried it a few times and it didn't really work. So if you could talk a little more about that, that would be great.
Yeah, definitely. So I have had And this is going to be super frustrating for everyone. It's frustrating for me because I talk to a bunch of different editors and I've listened to podcasts. I've listened to free webinars by like Tim Herrera from Smarter Living at New York Times. And he's had editors on there talk about it. And I've never heard editors say like the same thing. They all, well, that's not exactly true. They all say that a good story idea, even if it's in a pitch that's not amazing, not stellar, they'll be willing to work with it. But when it comes to the actual pitch writing, some common things I've heard are keep it short and sweet, a couple of sentences.
Right.
But then I actually talked to the former editor-in-chief of the Boston Globe, Susan Althoff. I had her as a professor at Emerson. I worked with her for a while. And very nice lady. She just had a book come out called Launching While Female. That's really good. But writing adjacent. And she told me, she was like, I don't mind if pitches are like a couple paragraphs as long as they use those paragraphs correctly and like smartly to convey their story and their idea and all the reporting that'll go into it.
Right.
I was like, okay. And then other editors, therapists, that's a look into my psyche. other editors will say, like, if it's over three sentences, not including a line for the clips, I just delete it. I'm like, oh my god, you're a monster.
Oh, yeah. But,
so what I always shoot for, so what I've found is I just have to do, you know, narrow it down to a few that sound reasonable to me and then like follow that advice. So for me personally, I have sent out the long pitches. There's actually a pitch. So I sent out a pitch about brain damage and romantic comedies for,
yeah, I saw that one.
Yeah. For Vice, because there was, that movie, I forgot the name of it now, with, the girl who gets her head hit and then it turns into a musical. And like a year before that, that Amy Schumer movie had came out called I'm So Pretty or Isn't It Pretty, something like that, when she got hit in the head. I was like, what is this? Why is everyone getting the head and having these like beautiful, like fun adventures? I wish I had that. I got a catheter and a poop tube, you know?
Yeah.
That pitch I actually took. It was one of my longer pitches because I felt it was necessary to explain that not only is this like a trope that this keeps happening in romantic comedies, but it is so divorced from reality.
Yeah.
That, like, there is so much I felt the need to explain. And then I explained why I'm the person to tell it, a little bit about my background. I did not mention the poop tube, but I should have.
Yeah.
But so that was one of my longer pitches, but even longer, it was probably like four paragraphs, I think. Each paragraph, like, three sentences, maybe three or four sentences. And that pitch I actually took, and I took a screenshot of it and I annotated it. So now whenever, writers reach out to me and they say like, hey, I have this pitch, but I'm not sure how I should word it, how I should structure it, I always send them that annotated pitch. And I'm like, here is, you should start off with your hook, why it's important, why people will want to read it, why they should read it right now, why it's relevant now, why you're the person to tell it, why it would fit with their readership. Because at the end of the day, I'll say this every single day, writing is a business, publication is a business, everything's a business, everything's a business, it's life right now. And they're not going to publish it if they don't think their particular readers, their section readers, their audience is going to read it. You know, they want people to click on it, and they won't publish it if people aren't going to click on it. If you can show them why this story is relevant right now, why people want it, and why their audience will specifically want it, God, you're in. They love it. Makes their job easier.
Yeah. That's great. Now, going back to the article that you were just talking about, because I did see that, and I think it's great that you wrote about the romantic comedies. What advice would you have for somebody who maybe wants to write about disabilities, who doesn't have one themselves, but they want to
they want to show that they're more empathetic, that they're not just going to use these tropes. Like, what advice would you have for somebody, whether they're writing maybe a screenplay or a novel or a story? Like, what advice would you give them?
So I would be hesitant to, what comes to mind immediately is all the Sia drama, because Sia wrote this movie called Music that came out and it has been nominated for some awards, and it's about autistic people and the autistic community. That I have a lot of friends in the autistic community, right. A lot of Twitter followers and people I follow on Twitter who are enraged about this movie, and I've read so many articles, and it's just, they're so angry because Sia didn't talk to any autistic people. And
yeah, that's problematic, definitely.
And the, like, one organization she reached out to has been historically shown to also do the same thing, like marginalize autistic people. There, I believe the organization was called Autism Speaks.
Yeah.
But it's, it's historically, it's been shown, it's bad, it's not good, it's not a good, autistic people don't like it, and she didn't even cast an autistic person to play the main role, so that's a case study of doing it wrong, completely wrong across the board. I would just start with, just talk to disabled people. Well, first, even before that, you have to look at, like, as a writer, why is this writer... why do they want to write a disability story? And what do they think a disability story is? And why do they, as someone who doesn't have a disability, feel the need and the right to articulate the disability experience? There's so many disabled writers writing it already. I would just suggest reading widely. And that's not to dissuade people from having disabled characters in their TV shows or books or novels or screenplays. On the contrary, you know, more representation is good. It's just try not to have them be these one-dimensional characters that you're throwing in just for diversity's sake, or to look quote-unquote woke. Yeah,
exactly. I think there's this idea that a lot of actors that you know, they'll play a disabled character and that'll make them more likely to get nominated for an award, because the people say, oh, they put so much research into finding out about what people like that go through. But it's, again, it's tropes. It's not really the real thing. So I think the representation is important, but I think a lot of people are looking at the wrong things, or they're not bothering to talk to people. So that's definitely, definitely important. So you mentioned the memoir in the bio that you gave me. What are some other writing goals? Like, what are some other things that maybe you haven't written yet, or maybe some areas of writing that you'd like to explore in the future? Talk a little bit about that.
That's a great question.
Oh, thanks.
That really makes me question my life. No, just
oh kidding. No.
I'm like, oh no. No, because it's the memoir that is not, it's in editing stages right now. Okay. I'm gonna start querying probably this summer, and it is pretty ambitious, and so it's just taking up so much time. Like, in my head, I'm just like, okay, I'll finish this, and then I'll deliquesce into nothing. Like, so I haven't really thought much beyond that. So I don't know, just like, if I had to dream big right now, I would love to just be able to write comedy and funny pieces, because one thing I'm in therapy for is that I basically only have two speeds. I'm angry or amused, and they bleed into each other a lot. So sometimes I'll be rage angry and cracking jokes, or I'll be, laughing, having a good time, and just being like, this is really terrible. I'm just kind of like, ah. So in a perfect world, I would be able to just, like, crack jokes and be consistently amused the entire time I was doing it and be able to not dip down to rage. But, I mean, the world on a whole is very far from being fixed, so I think that's a pipe dream. I think I'll always be.
Yeah, I'm definitely with you on that. If you could talk a little more, too, about teaching writing. You mentioned that it's right now you're doing it for first year students, and you said because you were taking graduate classes. So if you could talk a little bit more about what kinds of writing that you teach. I mean, I know it's like first year writing, but still any like anything in particular that you teach, and also what teaching philosophies you have when it comes, because I've taught I've done some graduate teaching myself for first year students, so I kind of know how that is for like communications and that type of thing. But like, what would you say your teaching philosophy is, if you have one, or what's some good approaches to teach something like writing to first year students?
So I think that for me, teaching writing, I feel like I have a slightly different approach than most of my colleagues, just because I did have to relearn a lot, pretty much everything in rehab. I had to relearn how to physically write, how to swallow, how to walk, how to think. And so based on all of those things, and I learned a lot about neurology and the brain, you know, things I hadn't really realized before. So I don't believe in stress. Like, I mean, it exists. I believe it exists. I'm not an idiot. Right. But I just, to me, it doesn't make any sense to stress out your students with arbitrary due dates and pressure them to meet those when you're teaching a foundational course. So my philosophy is, if the students aren't learning and retaining what I'm saying, then what's the point? They just wasted a year of writing school. They just paid all this tuition for nothing. They learned nothing. Because if you're stressed out, cortisol is released in the brain and you don't make memories. The whole time I was in rehab, that's what all my therapists were telling me. They're like, Brooke, your brain is especially new and just very weak right now. And I was like, oh, fuck you. But also, yeah. And they're like, it's very weak. And if you get stressed out, if you get upset, if you get emotional, you won't remember things. And it was absolutely true. Whenever I was stressed out, whenever someone made loud noises around me, like it was something as little as that, I just would like forget. I wouldn't even know what had just happened. So taking that in and knowing how frustrating it is to spend all this time working so hard and then just having no memory of it and feeling like you did all this work for absolutely nothing, I carried that over. Traumatic in itself. I carried my trauma over to make my teaching style trauma-informed. And so essentially my students, I tell them, I'm like, hey, you're going to have due dates, but they are not set in stone. And if you're having issues meeting them, if you need more help, if you need anything, we can talk about due dates. I'll push them back as far as I need to. And I talk about due dates even before I assign them. And I go, does this sound reasonable, this time frame? Because I do realize you have other classes, and I don't want you to forsake them for your foundational writing class. Especially because a lot of the students that I have, they're not even writing majors. Like, this class is just like a general ed, you know. Right. A lot of them are into film. They're filmmakers at Emerson Art School. So I'm like, hey, I know this might be out of your wheelhouse, a little difficult for you. I'm willing to work with you. And a lot of the readings that I assign, so I normally teach two courses. One is Intro to Composition, which is where we just teach them basic writing, how to create a proposition, set up an argument, argue that argument, or explore that topic, and construct it in a logical way. We're just teaching them how to think and organize thoughts, and be able to convey them to other people. Communication. And then the second class I teach is an extension of that one called research writing. And really in that, we teach how research goes into pretty much every genre of writing.
Yeah.
So I teach them, yeah, exactly. So I teach them memoir, I teach them annotated bibliography, compiling a bunch of different resources to understand a topic before you even write a research paper. And then I end with normally a popular essay form, like an op-ed or a think piece.
Oh, cool.
And it's just to show them that even when they don't think they're doing research. Every time they can't remember an actor in a movie and go to IMDb, that's research.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that's great. I'm actually with you on a lot of what you said about your teaching philosophy. I really think you do have to give students some, you know, you have to show that you trust them. And sometimes, you have to do certain things like set deadlines, but you can also let them know that you respect what they might be going through, and you know, you understand that, so you're more open than some other teachers might be. I'm totally with you on that. I would like to see more teachers definitely doing that. I also saw on your website that you use playlists for teaching, and you said to ask about that, so I would like to ask about that.
Oh yeah, I'm so glad you did. I love playlists. So what I would do when I haven't been able to do it since we've been online, but what I would do in the morning, because I would always teach the 8 a.m., so I requested them. I just do better earlier in the day.
I'm different from you there. I do better later in the day.
I used to be a night owl. I used to be the complete opposite, up all night. and then after my accident, I just had to set up a schedule for myself. And unfortunately, I just had to get in that 9-to-5 format because my outpatient therapy went from like 9 to 3:30 or something. So I had to completely alter my schedule. And then once I got stuck in that, I was like, you know what? I could just wake up really early, and that's the same thing as staying up late. So now I get up like ridiculously early, and I'm just like, this is also like being up in the middle of the night. This is perfect. So I just flip-flopped it. But that's why I would choose the 8 a.m.s, because I would already be up at like 4 writing and worrying about my son. Yeah, I'm the little gremlin in my room, just like cracking jokes, laughing to myself like a monster at like 4 a.m. I'm like, ugh. Like my roommates are like, Brooke, what are you doing? I'm just like up straining cold brew at like 6 a.m. and they're like coming out bleary eyed. I'm like, do you want some cold brew? But yeah, so then I would go in and teach. Well, I've already been up for hours. I'm like, people, and all my students are like half asleep. So I'm like, we gotta wake up. So I'd play like punk music. So when they would come in, I would be playing like Wire or
nice.
Yeah. Some of these like older punk, like the Only Ones, things like that. You know, upbeat, get something going. I went through a phase because I love Nick Cave's Cave in the Bad Seats. Yeah, oh man, I love Nick Cave.
Yeah.
But you know, post punk, like goth, that's goth rock for sure.
Yeah.
And he's a little more depressing than most punk music. So I went through a phase where I was just like, you know, Grindr Man, his like offshoot band, that's a little more lively. So I was and if anyone's familiar with Grindr Man, I don't know if you are.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's like Nick Cave on steroids, you know, he's just like, so I was just like, this is good. So I played great. So I did that for a couple of weeks. And then one of my students was like, it was the following semester. I had one student who I'd had the previous semester, and she had a friend in this class, and they came in the morning, and the friend like looked up and looked around because the classrooms have nice speakers. That was always nice.
Yeah.
And like I look up and around and was like, what is this? And then the girl I had had the previous semester was like, yeah, you get used to it. Brooke was playing a lot of this last semester. And I was like, okay, I gotta change for upstairs things. But that was kind of nice. It kind of works. I mean, a little fear is good, right?
I agree. Yeah.
And then when we peer reviewed, I would put on funk music like The Meters.
Oh, nice.
because funk music is just happy and it's calm and it's like, Well, maybe not like calm, but it's comforting. It makes me feel comforted.
Yeah.
And it's happy to me, and it makes me feel like, you know, it's a sense of community. Like, no one feels bad listening to funk music. So I'd put funk music on while they were doing peer reviewing and working on each other's. And I felt, I don't know if this was true, but I felt like it helped. It put everyone in the, like, right mood.
That's awesome. Yeah, you sound like an awesome teacher. Your students are very lucky to have you. And I really like everything you're talking about. And I really like everything that you've had to say. Is there anything else you would like to talk about or anything else you'd like to plug? I'm going to open it up to you.
Oh, well, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you for all of that. I love compliments. That's one thing that I always say across the board. Like, yeah, I mean, I'd date again, maybe, if I found someone who laughed at all my jokes and would touch my head gently and leave. If they would just leave and that was it. But I genuinely love teaching. I love my students because they're so smart and they really, especially this generation, like really Gen Z, they really care about the world.
Oh, yeah.
They're very nice to each other and they're very respectful. And even like the one time that I've ever had to like admonish, quote unquote, my students was because I have brain damage, I don't do well with the crosstalk. I get very confused. I forget what I'm saying. And normally my classes are very good, but a couple students, like a year and a half ago, they kept like cross-talking in the corner, and I just turned in the middle of class and I was like, hey, I'm sorry, I really hate to be this way, but you can't do the cross-talking because then I can't focus on what's going on and I can't listen to your students and pay them, or your peers, and pay them the respect they deserve, and it makes me feel like an asshole. And I just leveled with them. I was like, that's just the truth. And they were like, we're so sorry. And they actually came up after class and apologized again. I was like,
that's good.
I understand it. You were just in high school and you're excited. You're in a new community with new people, with new friends, and you're excited about what we're reading. And I'm excited and I'm happy that you're happy and that you're building this community. I just ask that you do it at the end or beginning of class, because I get confused, and then it derails everything. And they were like, yeah, we're so sorry, you know, and it was fine after that, and they never did it again. So that doesn't happen that often, but even still, you know, they're people. If you just treat them like people and you level with them, they're open to it. They're not trying to. I've never had a student that I was like, they are a bad person. I think just at their core they are a rotten person. That has never happened to me, and I don't think it ever will. But yeah, just treat people like people, which I kind of feel like even outside of academia, that's a pretty good way to handle life. Just treat people like other people.
I agree. I definitely agree. It's been really fantastic talking to you. I'm intrigued by everything that you've been working on and everything you've said. And I would like to, you know, in the future, have you on again. I mean, you're a great guest, really.
Oh yeah. Well, thank you. Hit me up anytime. I don't have a lot of hobbies. I just pretty much watch horror movies and write.
That's great.
So I really, really, really want to thank my guest, Brooke Nisely, for talking to me. And I really enjoyed our conversation and I learned a great deal. And I am going to include a link to Brooke's website in the notes for this episode. There are a lot of great articles on there about what she was saying about healthcare, about COVID, about disability, about comedy. I really think you should check it out, and there's a lot of great stuff on there. So, definitely check out the link to Brooke's website. And please let me know what you think. Email me at marissadelefarfalle@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter if you don't already at marissad13. And on Instagram at www.instagram.com/marissadf13. Also, please check out my Patreon page, www.patreon.com/MarissaDF. For $1 a month, I'll mention you in an upcoming episode, and for $3 a month, I will not only mention you in an upcoming episode, but I'll also give you exclusive access to 2 bonus episodes each month. I have 1 episode up there so far for the month of February, but we're still in the month of February. We have a week left. So I will put 1 other episode up on there within the next few days. And I also have episodes from January and December, which is when I started my Patreon page. So please, if you would like to check that out, absolutely. I hope you enjoy the content on there as well. So anyway, I am out of here for this week, and I look forward to bringing another, it'll probably be a solo episode next week, so I have no idea what I'm going to do it on, but even if I did, I wouldn't let you know about it, because I like it to be a surprise. I really, really, really want to thank you for listening, for all of your support, for all of your good feedback. And, really, really, the feedback is wonderful because it lets me know what's working, what's not working, what might be working but might even work better if I did more of it, that type of thing. Please, please, keep it coming, and I am so grateful for all of it. Until next time, have a great week, and please stay safe. Peace out.
This podcast has been brought to you by Anchor, which is the easiest way to make a podcast. Go to anchor.fm for more info.